We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Hey, this is Megan Rapinoe, and I'm Sue Bird. We've decided to turn our crazy IG live show into a podcast for your listening pleasure. Enjoy the show. A Touch More.
New episodes of A Touch More drop Tuesday only on the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores of the games every day?
Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment.
I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
What's up, Laker fans? Welcome to the Laker Film Room podcast, brought to you by betonline.ag. I'm Pete, joined as always by Darius, and we've been getting more and more news about the NBA coming back. They're still debating what it's going to look like, but in the process of that, they've got a lot to consider, right? They've got to consider the safety of the players, both in terms of COVID and just getting back up to speed. So today we've got a guest with us to help us talk through that. It's his first time on the show. You guys know him on Twitter at 3C Performance. He's got a physio background. He's got a couple of clinics in the LA area, sports science background as well. It's Dr. Rajpal Brar. How you doing, Dr. Brar?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. How are y'all doing?
Doing well, man. Thank you for joining us. So yeah, first let's get into the coronavirus components of this. Right now, there's no way to know exactly what they are going to do, but I think we can discuss a little bit of what are the factors that the NBA and the Players Association and everybody involved, what are the factors, Dr. Brar, that they need to be considering, and maybe some of the protocols that may be considered to make this as safe as possible?
I think the biggest thing, and so just one thing for clarity, is that a lot of this is, you know, and this would be an epidemiologist and expertise, but I have a good friend who's an epidemiologist, so I kind of know the phases and I follow it pretty well. And so I just want to get that out there, because being within scope is always important in the medical world. So by no means am I an epidemiologist in the field, right? And so, but that being said, the key thing when it comes to with COVID-19, it's going to be looking at how getting players together in the phases, how that affects if the players are actually getting the virus. So it's the same thing as in California, right? When you're reopening the stages and you're allowing people to mix together, you're going to see an increase naturally in some of these rates of infection. And so when it comes to the NBA, similarly, you want to see if you can really reduce that rate of infection via a very strict reopening. And a model we can actually use right now is looking at some of the European soccer leagues that are going through this thing, and they're a couple of weeks ahead. So, for example, at the English Premier League, they've done two rounds of testing. They have players already practicing together. The first round, they had three positive tests. The second round, they had two positive tests of over 1,000 players. And so the key is always constantly testing. And then as you see that the rates aren't going up, you then allow players and teams to do a little more when it comes to close contact. So it's all about phases.
So what sort of timeline then would you, from looking at all of this and your and the way that you're describing this makes it sound like there should be this gradual ramp up to even getting to the point where these guys would be practicing full time together and then much less getting on the court together to play an actual organized basketball game, right? And so what would a timeline and protocol look like kind of hand in hand to get to the point from your perspective where this could actually be viable?
So my guess is that the first thing that they do is a mandatory 14-day quarantine after this period where they're allowing teams come back to facilities. That's the first thing. And the key thing is you want to first test, you do a 14-day period, then you retest and you see how the rates differ. And then if it checks out, you do another 14-day period, because we know the general period when it comes to COVID-19 and comes to the course of it is about 2 weeks. So that then it made sense to do interval testing at 2 weeks to see how the increased contact and the increased reopening, for lack of a better word, is affecting those rates, right? So my guess is it's going to be a 14-day period initially where either the team is in their city or they're on campus, but they're quarantined within the people they've been around. And then you allow them to reopen to other to the next phase, which might be more 5-on-5 practices or whatever it would be, right? So it's just a phased reopening in that sense.
This brings up an interesting dynamic from a competitive standpoint of, you know, what happens if somebody tests positive, right? Like, they're probably quarantined for 2 weeks, right? That's about how long a playoff series is, right? If somebody, you know, tests at the beginning of game one, if it's a 7-game series, they may be out for the series, right? So there's all sorts of dynamics involved there. But from a keeping things safe standpoint, what are some of the options available for if somebody does, because players will, I don't know if there's any examples in the English Premier League that we can follow, but when a player does test positive, kind of how do you go from there?
So what you do is if a player tests positive, you do the same thing that some of these kind of countries that have treated this really well have done. You test and trace. So you want to see what players they were in contact with, what family they were in contact with, and then you test them, right? So you can trace back, especially when you have a smaller ecosystem, like with NBA players, you can actually figure it out better. So the way I think about it is that the NBA is almost treating this restart like South Korea or New Zealand did in the first place, which is really getting out in front and understanding if someone has it, you have to then figure out who else might have it and then confirm or deny that based on testing.
This is also interesting to me, right? Because there's this idea of contact tracing and quarantining folks. So the example that Pete brought up about a player testing positive potentially, I think maybe even just going back 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago or a month ago, the idea would be like that would be the end game, right? Like someone tested positive, that whole team is out, right? Mm-hmm. And this idea that one positive test will shut everything down, which is basically what happened with Rudy Gobert, the way that this all started. Are there things that we've learned from 2 months ago that make it where maybe they're viewing this as more appropriate risk, or there's less risk than what they would have thought before, and and where potentially a positive test wouldn't shut this entire operation down again?
I think the biggest thing we've learned in the last, I don't know, however long it's been since it all started, is that we understand the key transmission factors. Of course, there's still a lot to learn. But for example, some research came out that 90% of transmissions occur in close, crowded contact rooms like restaurants and churches. And then the other 10% happen through, whether it's through touching something. So the majority of transmission comes through this close contact. Whereas before it was like, okay, we're not exactly sure. We think we know, but we're not sure how it happened. So now if you understand the 90% aspect, you can then manage some of the risk and understand that one person having it doesn't mean that, hey, it's going to explode into this huge chain of events. And we also know, I think, I can't remember the exact number, but it's generally, I think it's been, with, for one person infected, it spreads to, I think, three other people. So I think that's been more definitively answered in that regard. So we understand that, yeah, it's definitely contagious, but it's not super, you know, you can manage the risk and you understand it a little bit better.
Let's move on then to the physical components of doing this beyond the virus. And thank you for giving your insight. I know that's outside of your scope, but I also know from our private conversations the amount of research you do into this. So thank you for sharing that. But more in your wheelhouse is the, you know, getting the human body up to speed. This is really a unique circumstance just from a timeline standpoint of, Darius and I will talk about this in the second segment, but however this works out, they're going to go from not playing a competitive basketball game for 4 months to playing playoff basketball soon thereafter. What are some of the challenges and, I guess, biggest concerns and risks that are involved in this really accelerated timeline?
Yeah, so generally, the biggest time period for increased injury risk is when you have these ramp-up periods, too much too soon. I could say anecdotally, like in my clinic, 90% of people is from doing too much too soon. But even in general, the research shows professional athletes, when they ramp up, even from preseason games to regular season games in a completely normal season, you see an increase in injuries just from that increase. And that's with players training over the summer, or hopefully training over the summer. And now you have a situation where you have an extended delay, then you have a shortened ramp up period, right? So it's all these factors that are increasing potential injury risk. Now, specifically, what you're looking at is soft tissue, meaning muscles, ligaments, tendons, bones. That's the biggest risk for players in this regard. And when it comes to individual players, like let's say in the Lakers, like there's videos of LeBron. He has a home gym compared to Quinn Cook, who's doing like mini sprints in his apartment. Who's going to be more in shape, right? Just so right. From that standpoint, you have now more variability across each player because they now have access to different equipment. Now, even LeBron doesn't have access to the full equipment. So it's really just been about mitigating how much fitness you've lost during quarantine period. And so, you know, you're going to play catch up the entire time, essentially. And hopefully we'll see with some of the time frames that come out. You know, but if the rumors are late July, you might have teams, they might get 6 weeks of a ramp up period, which, although not ideal considering how much time they had off, it's more than I thought they might initially have.
How long do you think they would need?
So need to get back to where they were before?
Yeah. Yeah, let's say they had all the time in the world in an ideal circumstance. How long would they need to get back into that same spot?
Man, considering they were just getting into ramp-up mode, like for the playoffs, I would say like, 2.5-3 months. And it's not just physically, it's the mental part of it too. Mm-hmm. Like what we forget about quarantine, it disrupts all your lifestyle habits, your sleep, your rhythm as a player when it comes to travel, your nutrition, all these different aspects are affected. So I remember a quote by LeBron when after it all happened, he was like, man, like I was just getting into this phase of really starting to, you know, he has a plan for everything. This is crazy about LeBron. He has a plan for every single day, you know, month of the whole season. So he was really preparing his body to ramp up. And so it's really difficult to go from that ramping up now down to like whatever you want to call it, but now hit the off switch and now back to the on switch.
No, speaking about LeBron's quote, like that was what I was going to bring up to you as well, is like he had said something along the lines of, you know, when all this started and we had to basically stop cold turkey, his body was basically telling him like, what the F are you doing? Basically, right? Because he went from that sort of, just like you said, that slow build and then wrapping around the All-Star break to then really starting to get into playoff preparation mode, and then the season just went away entirely. And when Pete asked his question about how long would it take to get back, I'm not even sure how you can actually get back to where they were, right? The Lakers had played, 64 NBA games? And there's no replicating the rhythm that you would be in three quarters of the way through the season. In my opinion, I'm not a professional athlete. I've never played in the NBA, but I think that there's a certain sense of physical condition and mental readiness that you could get to, but not necessarily the reps and the feel and all of the stuff that comes from playing for basically from mid-October through the first part of March. That's months and months and months of everyday reps and building your body and that muscle memory that comes with that. And I don't know how you recapture that even in an 8-week or even a 3-month process. Am I off base with that, or is it because these guys are professional athletes that it's like riding a bike for them?
No, I completely agree with you. I would say that estimate was more me rounding up. There's no way to replicate that aspect, and so I completely agree with that. And the key is just going to be figuring out the best way how to find yourself back into that mode. I don't know how they're going to do it, but it's just something I think part of it, following this Lakers team and how close they've been throughout the quarantine, is going to help them a lot, just because they still feel like they've still been in that team mode. So it may give them an advantage in that regard. But in terms of ever getting back to that playing, having played 64 games, even going back, the planning for the season starts in July for a lot of these guys, or even before that if you're LeBron. So you're not talking about October. You're talking about the plans now for however long have been completely thrown out of the loop. So will you ever get back to that point this season? Probably not. But I think you might be able to get close just based on the fact that these guys do tend to have a different mindset because they're at that professional level, and they do have access to really, really good professionals who can help them get there as well.
I want to get back to the point that you made, which is something that I didn't even consider about the different levels of conditioning that each of the guys might have based off of their own access to equipment and things like that. Do you imagine that these teams then are going to need to come up with even more specific and individualized workouts based off of not only body type and skills and the different types of exercises you might be doing with a guy like Dwight Howard versus a Quinn Cook, but also based off of where their individual bodies are at right now and the very specific injury risks that each guy might be facing based off of what they've been able to do to this point during this time off?
So my best guess is that they have a baseline assessment for each player, kind of where they were before they went out. And then they'll reassess when they get back in, and then you can clearly see the differential, right? So all these guys have individualized programs throughout the season that does cater to their own needs and specific demands. And then, of course, you have baseline principles. So they'll come back in, you assess each player based on that, and then you go from there. And so the hardest part is just, how do you get it back within the amount of time you're allotted for the season to restart?
So along those lines, Dr. Brar, just one last thing. I'm asking you to speculate a little bit here, but the position of the people that work for all of these teams that have to get these guys, their bodies back into the best condition possible, knowing that we can't get to where they would have been, what are some of the approaches that they can take? How do you make the most out of a pretty crappy situation and less than ideal situation for these guys' bodies to get in. I mean, it's what they're going to have to do, right? So considering the limitations and the circumstances, what are some of the, like, the most important things, the things they got to do first, the things they got to do best in order to kind of beat everybody else and make sure their guys stay healthy?
I think the biggest thing is, so there's when it comes to training, there's low-hanging fruit. So there's certain exercises that give you the most bang for the buck when it comes to, let's, like, squatting, deadlifts, like lower body big compound lifts. So you really want to hammer those home to start, and then the specialized aspects might go to the background. Whereas typically during the season, you're just trying to maintain a certain level. Now it's trying to rebuild as much as you can with those compound exercises, and then saving that specialized aspects maybe for afterwards, for what will be now the off season, right? So it's trying to balance the timeline with what works the best within that specific frame, because it's just so short. And so the other aspect for me is conditioning as well, right? And so it's not just lifting, it's conditioning. And that's what a lot of these guys have really been missing, is the conditioning aspect. And so it's just, there's protocols in place to get the conditioning back. And the key is just balancing it all, where you're looking, of course you want to put in the work, but you also have to focus on recovery and understanding if you push too hard, it's going to naturally increase some of their injury risk, and you might take two steps back. So it's like walking that fine needle. And the key here, I think this is the key with any team and training staff, it's going to be communication between the players. Because you're going to have these guys who are saying, the natural athlete tendency is like, oh, you know, I'm fine. Especially now knowing you want to come back, right? I'm good. So you really want trainers who understand the true indicators, right? Like, oh, you know, is this guy grimacing? He's telling me he's fine, but I'm seeing these differences, right? So you have to trust your objective indicators, especially in this regard, where you know players are chomping at the bit to get back and play ball.
One thing that interests me about all of this is Pete and I have talked about how the Lakers are well positioned based off of their experience as players, right? Like, they have LeBron James and Danny Green and even to a certain extent Dwight Howard and Rondo and all of these guys who were sort of veteran players. But veteran also equates to older, right? So you're talking about this ramp up in terms of physical activity. Do you think the Lakers are maybe at a disadvantage when it comes to, like, just the age and the minutes that some of their key players have put into the league to this point, or are they, like, no worse off than, like, your average team who has a bunch of guys in their late 20s or something?
So I would say, specifically looking at guys like LeBron, Rondo, Dwight, guys who put in the work consistently every day, typically I would say yes, right? But based on the specific characteristics of our older players, and these are guys who understand that putting in the work and being disciplined is so important, I would say they'll be at the same level as other players. I mean, if you just look at their, maybe not Rondo's, but if you look at Dwight and LeBron's physical just capacity this season, they're beyond most players who are already 5-6 years younger than them. In fact, with LeBron, I would honestly say this break gives him more of a margin between other players because he has such a reserve built in, because because he has such a margin for error with how incredible his training discipline is, that he's not the guy who's going to stop training. He's going to continue with his plan. He'll modify and adapt. And if anyone can max out their training ability during this quarantine, it's LeBron. So I think that beta, that margin for him, will actually increase.
Well, Dr. Barr, thank you so much. This was fantastic. Can you tell folks where they can find you?
Yeah, sure. So you can find me on social media, 3CB Performance, 3 Charlie Beta Performance. I have a YouTube channel that I also, you know, put player injuries performance videos out as well. And like Pete said, I have a couple clinics in the area. And so thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, man. Thanks so much. All right, we're going to
That's great. Super informative.
Very much so, yeah. Let's take a quick break, and then Darius and I are going to talk about some of the basketball elements of getting back to playing. There's no shortage of action going on our exclusive partner, BetOnline. NASCAR is back, and BetOnline has hundreds of other games, events, and sports to get in on. You can still bet on simulated NFL, NBA, and UFC events 24/7. Or you can participate in a $10,000 Madden Bracket Challenge, a March Madness-style NFL simulation tournament you can enter for free. And live right now on BetOnline's YouTube channel, you'll find an exclusive interview with ex-Chicago Bulls Ron Harper, Horace Grant, Bill Cartwright, and Craig Hodges to discuss the Michael Jordan documentary on what they're calling The Final Dance. Visit betonline.ag and use promo code BLUEWIRE, that's all one word, to receive your new welcome bonus and check out all the action. BetOnline, your online wagering solution. All right, so beyond the physical components of getting back and putting procedures in place for COVID-19 and all of that, the league is discussing with the Players Association, we're getting all kind of bits and rumors about how they plan on coming back. There are ideas about going straight to the playoffs, going with 20 teams, which seems to be the most popular option, where the 16 teams that are currently in the playoffs plus the four teams with the next best record from there on out, which will all be in the Western Conference, if that were the case, doing some sort of play-in. There are all sorts of versions of that can happen. There's a version where there's no conferences and it's just seeded 1 through 16. So Lakers would be playing the Nets in the first round as the 2 seed against the 15 seed if that were to happen. Kevin O'Connor had proposed a group play idea for the beginning stages of this. Darius, where do you stand on kind of how the hell do we make this return to normalcy in these completely bizarre times?
Man, I wish I had a good answer around this. I honestly do. There are so many, to me, factors at play. I do not think I'm for just going right into the playoffs.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Even if they play, quote-unquote, exhibition games. I just feel like you can't just say you guys haven't played any basketball at all, and then the first games that are played are playoff games that, are the highest stakes, right? To me, there's got to be some sort of middle ground there. I do not think all 30 teams should be called back. I think it's a waste if you ask the Warriors to come and play, or you ask the Knicks or the Cavs to come and play in basketball games. For what? There is still a safety aspect that I think matters here. I do think 20 to 24 teams sounds about right. I'm not sure about fiddling around with all the format stuff, though. So I'd be very interested to hear where you stand on some of the more hey, let's seed these guys 1 through 16.
Or sure.
Let's have a round robin tournament to decide the last four playoff spots. I think that those could certainly drive a certain amount of fan interest. I worry, though, about adding too many variables to something that is already sort of wonky to a certain extent.
Yeah, so you and I are simpatico on that, and this is more from a... I have this opinion more from a steward of the game perspective, right? It trying to care about the sport of basketball and the NBA rather than a Laker fan perspective. Because from a Laker fan perspective, hey, that bracket 1 through 16 don't look too bad, right?
It could be put the Bucks and the Clippers
and the
teams.
Celtics over there.
Put them all over there and let them have a bloodbath. And yeah, sure, let's give us all the teams that the Lakers have beaten pretty much every single time that they've played. That sounds good to
right.
me. Thank
Which is
you.
No disrespect to the other bracket, right? Toronto's a great team.
Yes.
I think Houston's a lot more dangerous than people give them credit for. I don't think it's a cakewalk, but I do think that it's a more favorable path than a conventional 1-8. So all of that being said, though, from the perspective of trying to root for what's best for the game and for the best for the NBA, in my experience just in life, that when you have a certain amount of upheaval that a lot of times in life is out of your control, right? It's something, it's an external event like the coronavirus outbreak has been, that it's best to keep the things that you do have that are solid and stable as solid and stable, because they're foundational things to build off of, right? Now, there's, I make this argument more off of the law of unintended consequences than anything specific about, oh, this would be terrible. The one thing I would say specifically about like a 1 through 16 idea is that I think that, you know, during this time, one of the competitive advantages that you have is Frank Vogel and his staff and all of these coaches. Like, we're going to find out who is really good at tape work, right? Because it ain't like you could be doing a whole lot else during this time. And so I think that that's something that, you know, if Frank Vogel should be watching more tape on the Clippers, right? And if all of a sudden the Clippers are not what he needs to, they don't have to get through them to get out of their conference or out of their bracket, there's some time wasted that I would have liked to know beforehand, right? But my argument is more so that when you make, the more changes that you make, the more things that happen that you're like, oh, I didn't realize that this was going to have that effect. So I think that keeping things stable, you know, I'd love for us to not agree entirely on that, but that is where I come from on that. Do you have, are there any points of contention in that?
No, but I think that my perspective is actually a little bit different, even though we may be arriving at the same place. I think a lot of folks look at this as an opportunity, right? Oh, these are all things we would have loved to have tried before, but we didn't have an opportunity to do it, right? Like, seeding 1 through 16 has been an idea that's been out there for years, but there was really no way to basically to whip the votes up in order to make that sort of change, because Eastern Conference playoff teams were never going to say yes, like,
and
like,
they still might not.
Yeah, like, there may only be four or five of our teams that make it, and those bottom three playoff teams or bottom two playoff teams are just like, you know, I actually think I'd like the gate revenue from hosting a home playoff game or two. So, yeah, we're not going to voluntarily say that you could seed 1 through 6, 16. And that's just one example, right? But I think that folks are looking at this as an opportunity, but to as sort of like a test balloon. Like, oh, let's try it out. But
when everybody's in the same place, right? Like, there's some argument for everybody's, there is no home games, there are no fans, there is no gate, no loss of playoff game.
There also isn't crazy travel, right? And and so you might have had us. I remember when they were talking about like 1 through 16 seeding like last season or two seasons ago, they were talking about the potential for like a second round playoff series between like the Heat and the Trailblazers, right? And that's sort of just like, yeah, how about that's like the farthest two distances that you can fly between NBA teams, and we're going to have them match up in the first or second round of the playoffs. Like, that doesn't make sense.
Do you go 2-3-2 to limit travel? Yeah,
exactly. And now, so that's another variable that's out the window, right? Everyone's at the same place. There are no travel hazards. There are no time zone shifts. There are no all of these other variables. And it's so... Maybe it sounds counterintuitive then for me to argue that these are circumstances that will never be replicated. So I feel like using this as an opportunity or to like test of to throw out a test balloon or
it's not applicable.
Try to get data on this that all of that is basically invalidated by the circumstances and the context of what the current reality is, right? And so you can't say like, oh, this, look how much more popular the like play-in turn will tournament was. Well, how do you separate the idea that that was popular versus everyone was just sports starved?
Yeah, we're
pandemic,
dying to watch this.
Right, and now the NBA is back after a 4-month hiatus. Like, like to me, there's so much messiness within trying to figure out what these new ideas would actually mean that I'm not sure if trying them for 1 year even makes that much sense.
Right. And to me, if they're going to do it next year, right? Next year is going to be weird, too. That's something that we don't really talk about or think about very much. But that season ain't starting until December at the earliest. And it's going to be a strange year, but it will also not have those those factors that, yeah, you can't replace. Like, yeah, let's say it goes well and they're all at a neutral site. Well, they're not going to be all at a neutral site ever again, knock on wood, right? So the travel, if you are going to go 1 through 16, it is going to have to deal with that. Yeah, maybe Miami has to and Portland have to play, and they've got to deal with the travel of that. You're going to have to sort that out in order for it to be sustainable on any level. Now, so then it comes down to, you know, what does it need to look like? So one of my concerns about a play-in tournament for those lower seeds is, what are we going to have, you know, let's say three of the six teams make it, or however four of it, however they want to do it. But those teams are going to have played 5, 6, 7 competitive basketball games, mm-hmm. while they go up against a team that hasn't played a competitive game in 4 months to start the playoffs. Like, do the Lakers get any play-in games? Do they get games where they get to ramp things up? How does that impact the risk factors that we were talking about with Dr. Brar at the beginning, right? Like, yeah, you don't want the Golden State Warriors there and the Knicks there and all that, because, like, yeah, it's more bodies, it's more chances to spread this thing. So I get all of that. But you also, from the other end, have to account for the competitive aspect, where, for one, you need everybody to be going into the playoffs with a comparable level of ramp up, for one. And on the second end, let's not act like we didn't play most of this season already. We were 65 games into this. So a team
some
like
teams were almost at 70, man. Like, right? Some teams had played like 67 or 68 games. Like, there were teams who were basically, the season was almost over.
Right.
Them.
So there should be, in the seeding and the play-in, like, a team like Memphis that has a game and a half advantage over the next closest team, if not more. I think they had a bigger lead than that. That should be reflected in how easy it is for them to make the playoffs. Let's not just even it out and be like, oh, well, you know, too bad you had a 3-game lead on this team, right? But
yeah,
you know what I mean? And yeah, so how do you balance out those competitive aspects?
Yeah, so it's interesting, B, because you know, like, ideas of play-in tournaments and stuff like that have been around for years, right? Because, like, and it's had to do a lot with, like, lottery reform and how do you combat against tanking, right? So there have always been these sort of ideas about how to make games, as you approach the end of the regular season, more important, right? Mm-hmm. Because so many teams were using those as, like, throwaway games and opportunities to tank and improve their draft position. Now, they tried to address that with lottery reform, but that's not going to fix everything. So if there was going to be a play-in tournament, I would want to give those teams that have earned a seeding advantage that type of boost that you would discuss. So maybe, like, you remember the old, three to make two rule.
Uh-huh. Yes.
It was, like, for, yeah, like, free throws for college basketball, and it might have even been the pros.
It was in the pros for like 3-4 years, yeah.
So you could use that same idea for a playoff series between some of the higher seeds versus these lower seeds, right? And you may have to have, so let's say you do bring 20 teams and you put the last two playoff spots available, or in each conference, so four playoff seeds total on the table for a play-in tournament between those final eight teams that come in, right? Maybe mm-hmm. you then say, like, you those the seventh seed in each conference get a bye, and then there's going to be this idea where, like, the way lowest seed has to win twice, and, like, the current eighth seed only has to win once.
Right. Right.
Like, things like that where you skew it heavily in the favor of the team who has frankly earned the right
very much
to
so.
Have an advantage.
Absolutely. Right? That's it. They've actually, so the interesting thing, though, is that a lot of times byes are what's done in sports and different competition brackets as a way of doing that. I'm not sure byes quite have the same benefit that they do normally, in that buys are partially for rest, right? You get the advantage of a little additional rest. Rest is not necessarily a good thing right now. Like, them playing games is going to be important. That's why if I ruled the NBA, I would love for the teams that do have some sort of competitive stake in this. So we shrink the league to 20 teams. I agree. Those are the teams that could make the playoffs. And then let's have everybody play 10 games, man. What's the hurry on this, to avoid the NFL? I don't think that's a good enough reason, right? I don't think that wanting to avoid the NFL on the weekends of the finals or whatever that's going to be is a good enough reason to accelerate this, right? People are going to watch the games. The TV people are going to be happy. Now, it comes down to I'm ignorant on the amount of exposure that these guys have to the virus, right? Like, is that something that is playing 5 games a big difference from playing 10 games? I don't know. But strictly from a competitive, let's get this and make this fair from a basketball standpoint, I think, especially with what Dr. Brar was saying in the first segment and all of that, like, there's no way to recapture or to get to where they were. We just got to do our best with what we have. Like, man, give them 8 games, give them 10 games, give them 10 games, and tilt the standings, right, to reflect that. If we get 10 more games, that puts everybody in that 75 to 78. That's almost a full season. TV, regional sports networks get to televise and make more revenue off of that. I think there are a lot of winners in that scenario that I don't think it has to be particularly convoluted. Just play a decent amount of regular season games to wrap this up amongst the teams that still have a stake. And if you've got a mixed East and West, you got to kind of come up with your own schedule to make this happen. It's to get teams warmed up and ready for action for this, while giving those teams that want to play in the opportunity to do so.
How would you feel about saying we want to get everyone, rather than saying we're going to play 10 games in this environment, that we want to give everyone an opportunity to get to 72 games played total?
That's fine.
Some roundish number,
sure.
Right? Like, the Lakers would then have 9 games, but a team like, I don't know, would there be a weird advantage if, like, a team like the Lakers who maybe have played 64 games? I don't even know the Lakers' record right now, like, off the
right.
top of my head.
I think it's 49 and 14. Yeah. So they played 63 games. Yeah.
So if they have, let's say the Bucks have already played 66 games and they only need 6 games to get there. Would that be too weird? Like, do you want to make it so that every team gets the same number of games before the playoffs start?
Yes, I want that rather than the same number of games overall for the season, because it's going to be long enough. It's going to be longer than a regular off season. So I think it's more important for everybody to play the same number of games from when they start, so everybody gets 10 games. And if that means one team plays 75 games on the season, the other one plays 77, who cares, right? But everybody gets the equal amount of ramp up to, by the time they get to the playoffs, we're not, like Dr. Brar said in the first segment, not at that full where we could be, but we're as close as we can get reasonably for this. So do you agree with that, or do you want everybody at that same number?
No, I think that having 10, I think everyone playing the same round number of games makes sense. Where things start to get tricky for me is if you're not bringing the same number of teams from each conference, then what is the benefit for, the fourth team from the West that's out of the playoffs who comes, right? Mm-hmm. And this idea that they've got to jump 4 teams to get to the 8th seed, or are you going to then combine that with seeding 1 through 16? Or I was listening to Zach Lowe's podcast, and he had mentioned that a team like let's say the Pelicans end up being the 10th seed, right? But they have a better record than the Magic. Mm-hmm. Then the Pelicans would then get slotted into the Eastern Conference, right? Mm-hmm. In order to be part of their play, that half of the bracket, while keeping East and West still separate, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think there's a bunch of ideas, because one of the arguments that Zach made was, like, we just came off The Last Dance, right? And we just saw how much rivalries matter. And this idea of playing the teams that are in your conference that are sort of historical rivals or recent rivals, like, that also adds drama and intrigue, and this idea of keeping that tradition that you had sort of spoken about earlier, that keeps that alive, rather than just this hodgepodge of, oh, guess what? We get Lakers Nets. Right, like in the first round, that doesn't mean nearly as much as if the Lakers played the Pelicans.
Of course,
right. So there's a bunch of stuff like that. So how far would you take this? Like, are there ways to manipulate things still on the back end where you get higher quality teams into the mix while still keeping a certain amount of that tradition alive?
Oh, that's a great question. I do like... So I want it to be... I suppose my guiding principle in this is it being fair for the competitors, right? The one thing that... So that idea from Lowe's podcast about, say, the Pelicans earn their place in, and but you slot them into the East because they're the ninth team, right? Or whatever, just to even things out. I don't love the idea of, for the Pelicans and for the Eastern Conference teams, of this kind of like one team you've only played twice. Well, it's a different circumstance than everybody else. The Eastern Conference teams certainly haven't been watching tape on the Pelicans. Alvin Gentry probably hasn't been watching much, you know, Toronto Raptors tape. You know what I mean? So...
It's probably not as fair to the Bucks either, right? Like, sure. Say, like if you're the Bucks and you're the number one seed, and you go from playing Orlando to now
freaking Zion, right?
Yeah. Zion and Brandon Ingram and all these guys, right? Yeah. Like, that's a different that's a much different scenario,
right? And so the guiding principle of fairness to me, we've played enough of the regular season where I feel okay being fairly rigid on the like what you have to do to play in. And all of that, like, we played 65 games, man. The 99 season was 50 games long. The 2011 season, I believe it was, or 2011-12. Which year was that? I think it was, in 2011, it was Kyrie's rookie year. So the 11-12 season, they played, you know, they had a shortened season then, too. I believe that was 66 games. So, like, we've played most of a season, and I'm fine with keeping things. And just in the general respect of... wanting to have fewer moving parts, and what I said at the beginning of just in my experience in life is that when you've got weird things happening, try to keep the things that you can keep stable. I think that just all of that to me points to a straight ahead conventional, or as close as you can to that with the playoffs. I think I'm in the minority on that, and I don't think that that's what's going to happen, but that's what I would like to see.
No, it's very interesting. And you asked me at the beginning, like, oh, what would you want to see? And honestly, I'm like, I wish I had a good answer with this. Like honestly, I feel like you could probably sell me on any number of scenarios.
Sure.
And in the end, I would be fine. It, like, if basketball actually does come back and this is a real thing, then I mean, I'm going to be smiling regardless.
Absolutely, man.
Like, there's NBA basketball. And
hell yeah, man.
And, you know, they could play on a freaking cruise ship for all I care. Like sure. Let's make this happen. Like, oh, you know, Anthony Davis just shot an air ball. Oh, well, you can't really blame it. You know, there was a big gust of wind.
Right, yeah. And it got a new game ball because it's in the ocean. Yeah.
That's right. But in the end, 16 teams, 20 teams, straight to the playoffs, you know, play-in tournament, group play. These are all great and fun ideas. I guess more as a traditionalist, I would skew more towards where you're at. But in the end, whatever we get, I'm going to be happy with it, I'm pretty sure.
And I love that the NBA is really listening to different arguments. There's supposed to be like three main proposals that are proposed fairly soon that for everybody to debate on. They don't need to make a decision right now, but it is fun to talk about the different paths that they can take. So, all right, yeah, we will continue to keep you updated and discuss the different elements of these this really, you know, extraordinary circumstance. But until then, you've been listening to Laker Film Room Podcast, and we will catch you guys next time.
Ainge has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front, broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
There's Magic, got it. Magic fires. It's good. The Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game.
Campbell in and out. The ball is tipped, and it's saved. 3 seconds left. Here's Van Exel. This is for the win. He got it.
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. An amazing performance by Kobe. With his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
in Boston. Of all places.
Are you kidding me? I know Red Auerbach is rolling over.
Kobe, hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal! Are you kidding me?
How strong was that? A triple and a fall away in the corner with a shot clock down.
Lakers by three.
Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Freddie pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
And the critical part was Pietrus jogging back, didn't bounce the floor. It's a two-for-one situation.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Powell.
There's the move.
Two, one, miss it.
Bryant. Unbelievable.
Bryant. Yes. And that was a little tap to Alvin Gentry.
Bad insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?